Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
Those violations of humanitarian law, the violations of the right to life, all the instruments that we've established in 1948 so far have proven to be, frankly, useless. We are really as close to the abyss as we have ever been.
The night won't end. A new documentary premiering today on Al Jazeera follows three Palestinian families in Gaza and takes an in-depth look at attacks on civilians by the Israeli military, as well as the U.S. role in the war. We'll play excerpts and speak with the journalists who made the film, director Kavitha Chikuru and correspondent Sharifa Belkadus. Then, a new film called Green Border examines the humanitarian crisis facing migrants from the Middle East and Africa who seek refuge in Europe and get trapped at the so-called green border between Poland, part of the European Union, and Belarus, a Russian ally.
From Belarus, we go to Poland, and then to your uncle in Sweden. Remember, everything is paid for, and he'll take you to the best border crossing.
What is that?
Get out. Let's go. Run.
We'll speak with Green Border's Agnieszka Holland. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As Israel's unrelenting assault on Gaza stretches into its ninth month, experts are warning of the compounding effects of the war on children. Children represent some 16,000 of the more than 37,000 Palestinians killed by Israel since October 7th. They're also some of the most vulnerable to disease and the worsening hunger crisis, with thousands malnourished and facing death. Another 17,000 children have lost one or both parents. Meanwhile, over 600,000 Palestinian students have been out of school for more than 8 months. Schools that have been turned into shelters for displaced Gazans have been regularly destroyed by Israel, including an UNRWA building in Khan Yunis, which was hit by an Israeli airstrike on Thursday.
There was a house next to us. They wanted to strike, and as you can see, the classroom where we shelter is damaged. I don't know where we will sleep. We are 25 people in this classroom. Look how it's damaged in our sleeping area. Where will we sleep? We don't know. We will have to sleep in the yard.
In related news, the first Palestinian athlete to ever participate in the Olympics died last week in Gaza's Nusayrat refugee camp after he was unable to receive medical care for kidney failure. Majid Abu Marahil, a long-distance runner, represented Palestine in the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, Georgia, where he was the flag bearer. The United Nations Environment Program warns Israel's war on the Gaza Strip has spawned an unprecedented environmental crisis with worsening soil, water, and air pollution and risks of irreversible damage to Gaza's natural ecosystems. In a new report, the UN finds Israeli attacks have generated 39 million tons of debris with severe damage to Gaza's water, sanitation, and hygiene systems. The destruction of solar panels and the dispersal of heavy metals and explosive chemicals. This is Fatima Al-Shanbari, a displaced Palestinian whose family is sheltering in Jabalia.
Every week, my son stands crying because of the pollution of water here. We have hepatitis, which causes yellowing of the eyes. We also have intestinal infections. Not just me, but the whole shelter. Everybody suffers from this condition. There's no clean water. The water is not suitable for drinking. We are forced to drink it, even though it is not clean at all. I swear to God, we do not accept it. Even filtered water isn't really filtered. We fool ourselves and pretend it's filtered.
The International Women's Media Foundation is under fire for rescinding its Courage in Journalism Award to the Gaza-based Palestinian journalist Maha Hosseini, following a smear campaign by pro-Israel groups and false accusations of anti-Semitism. Maha Hosseini responded in an op-ed published in the Middle East Eye, quote, "Winning a prize for courage means being subjected to attacks and choosing to continue your work regardless. Regrettably, the very organization that recognized these perilous conditions and awarded me the prize chose to be uncourageous," she said. Wikipedia has declared the Anti-Defamation League a generally unreliable source on the Israel-Palestine conflict and a major PR blow for the pro-Israel group. The majority of Wikipedia editors found the ADL to be heavily biased against Palestinian rights. The label puts the ADL in the same category as Fox News and Amazon Reviews, among other unreliable sources. Editors are also considering applying the unreliable designation to the ADL in relation to anti-Semitism. With New York's primary election just 4 days away, a super PAC affiliated with the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, is spending roughly $17,000 an hour to defeat progressive Congress member Jamal Bowman, who's spoken out against Israel's war on Gaza. That amounts to $14.5 million spent by APAC in around a month, making it by far the most money ever poured in to a House primary race by any interest group. In other election news, Donald Trump has proposed granting green cards to foreign nationals who graduate from U.S. colleges in a major departure from his usual anti-immigrant rhetoric. Trump made the remarks after being asked in a podcast about staffing U.S. companies. Following the comments, Trump's team issued a statement reassuring his supporters that he still plans to impose the most aggressive immigration policies in U.S. history, quote, to exclude all communists, radical Islamists, Hamas supporters, America haters, and public charges, he said. A new study finds global heating from human activity made this year's late spring heat wave in the U.S., Mexico, and Central America 35 times more likely to happen. Meanwhile, scorching summer heat is compounding the suffering of asylum seekers at the U.S. southern border. The Sunland Park Fire Department near El Paso, Texas, has recorded the deaths of at least 13 people in the desert so far this year. This is Fire Chief Ramiro Rios.
Recently, we've been having a lot of temperatures that have gone over 100 degrees, and we are starting to see that we are getting a lot of migrants that are going into heat stroke. And so now we're having to deal with having to use what we call ice baths. So it's a rapid cooling technique that we're using by putting them in a body bag and then filling them up with ice water and ice so that they can we can bring their temperature down.
Hawaii has reached a legal settlement with a group of youth climate activists who sued the state over its greenhouse gas emissions. Under the legally binding agreement announced by Governor Josh Green, Hawaii agrees to fully decarbonize its transportation systems to achieve zero emissions no later than 2045. Meanwhile, Britain's highest court has ruled government planners failed to consider the harmful effects of global heating when they approved a new oil well near London's Gatwick Airport. It's a major victory for environmentalists and a setback for Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, who's pledged to max out the UK's oil and gas reserves. Climate campaigner Sarah Finch led the legal fight against the oil well.
In climate science, we hear a lot about tipping points, Amazon deforestation, melting permafrost, things that accelerate global warming in an unpredictable and frightening way. I think today we've just seen a tipping point in the other direction. No longer will any planning authority be allowed to wave through fossil fuel production without fully considering the climate impact.
The U.S. Supreme Court upheld a Trump-era tax on overseas investments. The case stemmed from a challenge to the mandatory repatriation tax by a couple who sought to avoid paying a one-time $15,000 tax levy related to an investment in an India-based company. Senator Elizabeth Warren welcomed the decision, saying, quote, right-wing billionaires hoped an obscure legal case would blow up the tax code to avoid paying what they owe, but this effort failed, she said. Analysts warn the ruling, however, does not resolve the constitutionality of wealth taxes, and billionaires could challenge future laws requiring them to pay their taxes. Vladimir Putin met with Vietnamese Prime Minister Pham Minh Chinh in Hanoi Thursday, with the two nations pledging closer cooperation on energy and security. Meanwhile, South Korea summoned Russia's ambassador and said it'll consider supplying weapons to Ukraine after Putin and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un signed a mutual defense pact this week. Speaking from Hanoi, Putin said Moscow is considering lowering the threshold for use of nuclear weapons and supplying arms to Pyongyang.
We reserve the right to supply weapons to other regions of the world. Bearing in mind our agreements with the Korean People's Democratic Republic, I don't exclude that either.
And the acclaimed actor and lifelong activist Donald Sutherland has died at the age of 88. During the Vietnam War, Sutherland, Jane Fonda, and others formed an anti-war roadshow called the FTA, or Free the Army. Modeled after Bob Hope's USO tour, the group traveled to perform for soldiers who came out against the war. In 2017, declassified documents showed Sutherland was on the National Security Agency's watch list between 71 and 1973. On the big screen, Sutherland was known for his scene-stealing roles in JFK, The Hunger Games, Don't Look Now, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and Pride and Prejudice, among others. Donald Sutherland has five children, including the actor Kiefer Sutherland. Kiefer Sutherland's maternal grandfather, Tommy Douglas, is considered the father of Canada's single-payer health care system. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. As Israel's war on Gaza stretches into its ninth month, we begin today's show by looking at a new documentary that's premiering today on Fault Lines on Al Jazeera English. The film is called The Night Won't End, and it takes an in-depth look at attacks on civilians by the Israeli military in Gaza and the United States' role in the war. Over the course of several months, the filmmakers worked with journalists in Gaza to follow three Palestinian families as they recount the horrific experiences they've suffered and their struggle for survival amid the relentless Israeli assault. This is an excerpt of the film that starts with the Secretary General of Amnesty International, Agnes Callemach.
The number of victims, the collective punishment, the denial of humanitarian assistance very early on, those violations of humanitarian law, the violations of the right to life, all the instruments that we've established in 1948 so far have proven to be, frankly, useless. We are really as close to the abyss as we have ever been.
I swear I can't sleep. I think about them all night. I look at their photos and cry over them. Young girls, they are 6 and 8 years old, without a mom. These girls have no mom. They ask me, where's mama?
And despite the massive loss of life and numerous allegations from human rights groups of violations of international law, the United States, Israel's main ally, never wavered in its support.
I think the U.S. has actual knowledge that war crimes are being committed. Of course we do. They are in the newspapers and on the television every day. And we certainly have other means of knowing what is happening in Gaza. And yet we continue to provide the arms that enable these. So inherently we are complicit.
Among Gaza's more than 2 million people, no family has been spared the impact of this war. To understand that struggle, we worked with journalists in Gaza to hear the stories of three families about their devastating losses and what it's been like trying to survive.
When the night falls, it feels endless. You even wake up all night wondering, will the morning arrive? Iyad, when he wakes up at night, he puts his head under my head and hides his face from the night. He asks me, is the night not over? Is the night not going to end? The night won't end. The night is long. The night is terrifying. The night means fear. The night means remembering Hind.
An excerpt of The Night Won't End, a new documentary premiering on Al Jazeera English today. That last voice was the mother of Hind Rajab, the six-year-old girl killed by Israeli forces in Gaza, one of the three families profiled in this devastating film. We're joined now by two of the people who worked on the film. Kavitha Shakuru is a journalist and the director of The Night Won't End, and Sharif Abdelkaddous is the correspondent on the film, also a longtime Democracy Now! Correspondent. They're both here joining us in our New York studio. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! This is an epic work. It is devastating. Sharif, talk about the scope of the work and the families that you profile and why you chose to do this.
Well, I think, you know, when doing a documentary or any film on Gaza, it's very hard to decide where to begin and what to focus on. The sheer scale of what's happening there, not just the mass killings of civilians, but the complete erasure of all aspects of civilian life. The destruction of homes, schools, universities, the entire healthcare system, hospitals, mosques, churches. The unprecedented number of UN workers who have been killed, the unprecedented number of journalists who have been killed, the killing of the future with the unfathomable number of children who have been killed. So no piece can really quite capture the magnitude of the atrocities in Gaza. But what we tried to do in this film is to follow three families and follow, document their struggle for survival in Gaza. And what you find is that it's almost nearly impossible to stay alive in Gaza. They're constantly searching for safety, and each family's case tells a wider story of the war. So we look at the Selim family, where there's a massive airstrike on their home, and airstrikes, of course, have been almost unprecedented in this war. We also look at the killing of civilians in so-called humanitarian zones or so-called safe zones, where people are forced to be displaced to, ordered to go, and told they're safe, but they're hit there as well. And we look at the killings of civilians and the arbitrary execution of civilians by Israeli ground troops. So we try to provide this tiny glimpse through a combination of investigative journalism and up-close and personal storytelling. And we look at the U.S. role in all of this. The Biden administration's continued backing of the war and its ignoring of international humanitarian law, its ignoring of domestic law in its continued backing of Israel. And finally, normally at Fault Lines, we cover stories on the ground. And obviously, journalists have been barred from entering Gaza for the past 8 months by both Israel and Egypt. And so the reason we know anything about what's happening in Gaza, what we've known over these past 8 months, is because of Palestinian journalists on the ground in Gaza, who have done incredibly brave work, who have shouldered all the labor of covering this war, and who have been killed in record numbers by the Israeli military. And so we worked with, this film was only made possible by this team of Palestinian journalists that we worked with over the course of several months, who followed these families, who filmed with them, who interviewed them, who did a lot of the reporting. Some of the cinematography is quite stunning. We're very used to seeing this conflict on footage shot on phones. And you really see the difference when people are filming people up close in this way. And finally, you know, these journalists, of course, suffered and go through the same things as the families that they're covering. They've had family members who have been killed. They are displaced. They are hungry. They don't have food to feed their families. It's very hard for them to get around. And so this film is really a testament to their courage, to their bravery, and their dedication to telling the story of what's happening in Gaza.
So, Kavitha, you're the director of the film. If you could talk a little bit more about what Sharif said, how you found the journalists to work with, how you coordinated with them. And one of the things there are many things that are amazing about the film, but one of them is the fact that you, as you're talking to these families and they're recounting what's happened to members of their family, often several members of their family, you can show footage of the family members they're speaking of who were killed or otherwise injured when it actually happened. So on the one hand, you're interviewing people, they're recounting what happened, and then you're showing live footage from that time. So if you could talk about that, and in particular the how you coordinated with all these different journalists on the ground in Gaza.
Yeah, so we worked with a really amazing Palestinian production company called Mediatown. They have a long-standing relationship with Al Jazeera, and they have teams around Gaza who do news coverage and documentary coverage. And so, you know, like Sharif was saying, these journalists are living through, while they're covering the war, they're also experiencing the same things that they're covering, right? So starvation. Hussein, the producer in the north, his daughter was killed by ground troops in December, and she was 4 years old. And he himself was also severely injured and had surgery while the team was filming for this documentary. So they're experiencing all of these things as they're also doing this work, you know, to show the world what is happening in Gaza. And in terms of coordinating, it was, you know, the teams. One of the things that probably sounds simple, but it's not. It's the communication. They don't have cell phone coverage or steady internet access, and so even just sending us the footage was a matter of them making sure they were safe enough to go up to a roof and send the footage. And even that was a big piece of it. And another thing is that, you know, with some, that was one part, and we also worked with a number of other independent journalists that we found. And a lot of times these journalists have their numbers on their Instagram profile, which is how we got in touch with them. And it's, I say that only because I feel like the larger journalism industry could do a better job of connecting with journalists on the ground. You know, Democracy Now, I think, is one of the few places that I feel like I've seen journalists from Gaza constantly on air. You don't see that on a lot of networks. And I, you know, these journalists are there shouldering the burden, and they're ready to do that work. And I think more of the industry could be getting in touch with them.
So one of the stories in the one of the families that's profiled is the family of Hind Rajab, the six-year-old girl who was killed by the Israeli military. We just heard in the introduction, as part of your the film, Agnes Kalimar saying, "We are as close to the abyss as we've ever been." And her story perhaps exemplifies that more than any, if you could say, Sharif.
Yeah, I think, you know, Hind Rajab's name is known around the world because after she was killed in late January by the Israeli military, the recording of her voice speaking to the Red Crescent was released and broadcast, and it reverberated across the globe. And she became a symbol of Israeli violence against civilians and a symbol of Palestinian strength as well. And she really became an icon. And we saw here in New York City at Columbia University students who took over a building, named it Hinds Hall in her honor. But what we do in the film is perhaps provide one of the most comprehensive accounts on video of the killing of Hind Rajab and her relatives by the Israeli military. And what happened was we speak with her mother, Wissam Hameda. And her mother fled her home in Gaza in the north, trying to seek shelter in the south. The south continued to be bombed. So she decided to return back to the north with her two children, her son Iyad, who I believe is 3 years old, and Hind, who's six. And they stayed with the relatives in the north, including her 15-year-old cousin, Leyen. January 28th, there was very heavy attacks by the Israeli military in Gaza City, near where Hind and her mother and relatives were staying. She describes that the family was trying to huddle in the center of the apartment because the fire was reaching on the outside. So the next morning, they decide they have to leave to find safety. Wissam's uncle, Bashar, takes his daughter, Leyen, who's 15, Hind, and gets in a car with and says, "We're going to drive to another town to find shelter. I'm going to come back to get Hind's mother and Iyad, her brother." As soon as they leave, they're fired on by the Israeli military. Hind's mother actually sees this. It's only a couple of blocks away. She can't get to them. There's firing in the area. She somehow manages to flee on foot. As soon as they find shelter, she calls the Palestinian Red Crescent in Ramallah to try and get someone to rescue and find out what happened. So first she tries to call her uncle, Bashar. Calls, no one answers. Who picks up? Leyen. the 15-year-old cousin of Hind, she describes to Hind's mother that everyone in the car has been killed except for her and Hind. Both her and Hind are bleeding, she says. We've been injured. So they get in touch with the Red Crescent, and we're going to play a clip right now from the documentary where the emergency medical worker at the Red Crescent in Ramallah, Omar Al-Qom, calls Layan to try and figure out what's happening.
Eventually, relatives were able to reach the Red Crescent in Ramallah to see if their team in Gaza could send an ambulance.
We received an appeal that the car had been targeted in Fares gas station in Gaza City.
When Omar called, it was Layan who picked up.
Hello, dear.
They are shooting at us.
Hello.
They are shooting at us. The tank is next to me.
Are you hiding?
Yes, in the car. The tank is next to us.
Are you inside the car?
Hello?
A girl dies while she's on the phone with you. I disassociated. I reached a stage where I was just mentally cut off. I'm trained for situations like this, but when it involves a child, your emotions get all mixed up. After calling back the same number that Layan answered, the voice sounded different this time. So I asked her, the girl that was speaking with me, where is she? She told me, she's dead. Who am I speaking with now? Hind?
After a few minutes, Omar asked other colleagues to help and speak with Hind.
The tank is next to me. The tank is where? Next to me. The tank is next to you? Yes. Is it moving or still? Did anyone come out of it? It's moving. It's moving? Okay. Is it moving next to the car? Behind the car or in front of the car? In front of the car. The tank is coming towards you from the front of the car? Yes. Is it close? Very, very. And it's moving? Yes. Come get me.
As the Red Crescent dispatchers spoke with Hind, colleagues were trying to get an ambulance, something that would require coordination with and approval by Israeli authorities.
Usually, ambulances in the whole world, once they got the call, they directly dispatch the ambulances and send to save people's life. Unfortunately, this is not the case in Gaza.
Come get me.
Any area that there is Israeli occupation forces, Israel considered as it is a military zone. That means even if there is wounded people, people who are killed and need to be evacuated, we are completely denied access to these areas. And if any ambulance to try to reach, it will be targeted. That's why in order to be able to save Hind, we had to coordinate our safe access.
That last voice was Nabil Farsakh, the spokesperson for Palestinian Red Crescent, explaining how emergency medical teams in Gaza need to get clearance from Israeli authorities before going in to rescue Hind. They do get that clearance. Let's turn back to the documentary to see what happened next.
Finally, nearly 3 hours after requesting clearance, the Red Crescent says Israeli officials gave the approval for the ambulance to go to the scene and provided this map with an approved route.
We had to wait almost 3 hours until the green light was given. So they sent a map with a route, which means it identifies exactly which route the ambulance should take. And once we received the green light, the ambulance was dispatched.
Oh, أحلى خبر في الدنيا من عمو عمر.
هند هنود هاي دقيقة واحدة بتكون السيارة عندك بس بتمشي شوي شوي
محطة فارس وين وصلت؟
The two paramedics who started driving to the scene were Ahmed Al-Madhoun and Yusuf Zeno. By the time they left, the sun had set.
Can you see the car?
I can't see a thing here.
Do you have your siren and flashing lights on?
Just the lights, not the siren. Oh, there it is.